Marcos Mulitzas Zuniga, your hot contender for the honors as the most promising blog on the left side of the blogosphere. Describe the role you want to play in this new electronic wonder space, whatever it is, the Daily Kos.
I think the role is to galvanize support, galvanize a lot of people that have otherwise been excluded from the political process, either from a institutional standpoint or from just an apathetic standpoint.
Are you saying specifically people who've been excluded as opposed to defeated or just bored to death or lost interest?
Yeah, all of the above, all of the above. I mean, the idea being is that there are a lot of people who are either, like I said, excluded for whatever reason, or people who are political junkies who simply don't have an outlet to express their passion. I mean, it's very, very wonkish kind of area to be in, and you know, to be honest, most people really don't care. So here we're creating a community online that is pulling together all these people that have otherwise been marginalized or ignored or laughed at or who simply weren't part of the political process, and we're providing them with the information necessary to make certain decisions. You know, I'm not telling people how to think. Other blogs aren't telling people how to think. The idea being is we provide the information, we provide the source material, the links, and there is some spin, obviously. But the idea being, you know, this is what we think, this is how I interpret the information that I see. You can go read it yourself and you can make up your own mind. And if you agree, you know, great, this is a place for you to hang out with and talk to other people that think similarly. You know, we each fill our niche. You know, there's Atrios who has his little corner on the left blogosphere. You have Tom Tomorrow, the cartoonist. For whatever reason, mine has attracted a lot of traffic and a lot of, it's become quite the community, and I'm gratified.
So? I mean, people want to bill you as the Instapundit of the left. How does this happen?
How does it happen? That's a really good question, because I have no clue. I have some suspicions, though. One of them is this whole notion of community, the notion that my weblog is very much different than Instapundit. I think Atrios is more of a counterbalance to Instapundit, because Instapundit is a lot of really quick hits, not a lot of analysis. It's just mostly link, you know, dozens of them a day, while I really tackle tops 8 blog posts a day, and, you know, it's a little more involved. But the idea is that when I started this site, I wanted to do something that was very inside baseball regarding politics. The war was, you know, kind of took me away from that for a while, and I had some, you know, I served in the military, so I had some firsthand experience, which gave me some credibility on the topic. But in general, yeah, that's exactly what I do, you know, and as the elections get closer and closer, it starts, you know, the site starts taking that tone of voice again. So I think what's happening is that you have a lot of people who love to talk about politics, love to discuss polls or you know, demographics or issues like that, but never really had an outlet for it before.
Let's be real. First, the war made Instapundit, and the war was good for you in as much as Forbes magazine said you were among the top war bloggers and maybe the top anti-war blogger. In a big picture, it seems to me the war bloggers, including Andrew Sullivan and Ben Reynolds, kind of won the war round, and yet it's Howard Dean and this new generation of bloggers to the left or sort of over the whole battlefield that seem to have command the future. What's your sense of the score in the blogging wars left and right, Republican and Democrat, as we approach 2004?
Well, I would first argue that the right didn't really win the battle of the war. I mean, it's still going. People are still dying.
Absolutely.
And
I'm talking about the blog war.
Yeah, the blog war. The score. I mean, there's no doubt that Instapundit is far and beyond the highest trafficked political weblog. He's at about, you know, looking at the stats, he's about 70,000 unique visitors a day. I'm at around 30,000 daily. Mm-hmm. So I'm not even halfway to his level. I'm growing a lot faster than he is. And I'm not going to say I'll pass him, but I'll say that at some point I will be a lot more competitive. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of that is just, he's been around for a long time. There's a lot of upstarts on the right. But generally speaking, I think the left is a more dynamic, has a more dynamic blogosphere, blog culture. Part of that is this feeling that the mainstream media really has abandoned the left, has abandoned all pretensions of even being balanced. I mean, if you look at the coverage that Clinton received compared to the coverage that Bush has received, a $50,000 failed real estate venture, you know, cost the country $60 million in all sorts of heartache and troubles thanks to Republican investigations, while, you know, Bush has millions of dollars of questionable deals through, you know, various companies. and, you know, nobody bats an eyebrow. So, you know, there was this feeling on the left that the mainstream media is useless when it comes to really informing the public and informing us, ourselves, of what's really going on, so that we needed to provide some kind of counterbalance. Now, there are plenty of small outlets or even individual stories in some of the major papers that talk to the issues that we're interested in. You know, some of these failed dealings, the fact that the war is going poorly and nobody really wants to talk about. It just isn't being pursued by the mass of the media itself. So what the blogs are allowing us to do is to pick out these nuggets of information that trickle out from regular mainstream sources,
right,
and amplify them ourselves because nobody else is amplifying them.
What is it that makes Howard Dean and his personality, his imagination, his political vision such a perfect fit with the bloggers?
I'm not so convinced that it's the perfect fit. I think it's not so much the ideology itself. I think it's this notion that you have a campaign that is willing and eager to listen to what its supporters have to say and willing to take that into consideration. I hear so many times about people who say, yeah, I'm pro-gun control, so I disagree with Dean on that issue, but, and when you get into the but, it's all about, at least he'll listen to me. At least I know they're listening. At least I know that I'll be taken into consideration, that I'm not just a focus group, as Bush called millions of anti-war protesters. And I think that's really, really key. I think pretty much anybody could successfully pursue this kind of strategy. But one, you have to, like I said, you have to be able to decentralize. You have to give people the freedom, and you have to trust them to write on their own without really having it all be political speech. That's number one. Number two, you have to encourage that community. You have to have that commons board, and have people talk back and allow dissent to happen, because a lot of that dissent is an important part of the political process. And I think there's this feeling within people who are on the Dean bandwagon that he's listening. They're not, you know, we're not being censored, and we're not going to agree with everything, but we can respect each other because we all have our beliefs, and nobody's going to believe exactly like me. But at least I know I'll have an ear in a Dean administration. So that's why, to me, it's really hard to picture Bush kind of pursuing this kind of strategy, because it would require them not only to pretend to listen to people, but to genuinely listen to people, to embrace this public. And it's something that Bush has never done in this entire time in office. That doesn't mean that other Republicans couldn't pull it off. They easily could. But, you know, Bush is not... I just don't see Bush.
I wonder if you're underestimating the Instapundits of the world, in the sense that they, just with nerve and confidence and a kind of rogue intellectual energy, they held their own in the war debate, and then some, I think. I mean, they didn't persuade me, but they became the place you had to check in for hot information, good information, interesting argument. And they could do that again around Bush, it seems to me.
Oh, they could. I'm just talking within the Bush campaign itself. As far as the conservative bloggers, yeah, they'll definitely be boosting them. It's funny because to me the best war commentary from the right came from a blogger called Tacitus, who's by no means, I mean, he's very conservative. He's by no means a shill of the administration. But he also recognized that there was a lot of intangibles in war, and that a lot of the absolutes that were being spotted by the right were... A lot of it was just faith, you know, the notion that we'd be greeted with open arms and there would be no rebellion and XYZ. So I don't underestimate them. I think they probably get more traffic than liberal bloggers at this time. But when I look at a growth trajectory, I think that the liberal blogosphere has a lot more room to grow than the right.
Let's talk about California, just because everybody in the world is talking about your governor's race. How do we watch California over the next few months and see in 2003 where the country could be heading in 2004? What's actually significant out there in this race?
Yeah, I don't think there's much of a lesson to be learned from California from this election that will parlay into any kind of national significance. I think for that, nobody wants to look at those races, but I think it's more important to look at Kentucky, Louisiana, and Mississippi that are having gubernatorial races. I think that'll be a bigger bellwether of just how popular Bush really is at this time. California shows is what democracy run amok looks like. I mean, you have a system where the governor may receive 49% of the vote in the first half of the ballot and then lose, yet have somebody who can only garner 20% of the vote win his seat, take over that seat, which is ridiculous on the face of it. I can guarantee that the second, if a Republican is to win that office, with the next day we'll be collecting signatures to make sure that that individual is recalled sometime mid-next year.
If Arnold wins, you mean to say he faces a recall
immediately?
Immediately.
The domains have been registered already. Willie Brown, for one, has already said that he'll fund it himself. A lot of other people are already talking about it. I don't think they even need to fund it. I think there will be enough pissed off people in the state that they can collect those signatures within a matter of weeks. I mean, we're talking about 800,000 signatures. It's going to be even less because you need 12% of the votes cast in that last election. So we figure in this recall election, turnout will probably be lower than the general election. Davis won last time. So you may be looking at 700,000 signatures is all you need to force another recall. It's a ridiculously low bar to reach. But I think that once, you know, say a Republican does win, we turn this around, we force out the Republican governor, and now that both sides have been stung, then maybe they'll do the smart thing and amend the Constitution to make it a little bit more rational than just a mere 12% of the votes cast.
Who are you rooting for?
I am going to vote no on the recall and vote for Cruz Bustamante in the second half of the ballot. The thinking being that you have to have it's just a question of a safety valve. I mean, you hope that the recall fails. I, by no means, am a fan of Davis, and I would actually prefer to have Cruz Bustamante as governor. But there's a certain amount of principle involved, and one, showing that this whole recall effort has been, you know, it's an absolute disaster for the state. I think it's imperative that it fails to really drive that point home. Otherwise, if it's successful, then it becomes a tool that can be. We'll have elections every year in the state. It's just far, far too easy to force a recall. So I think it'd be important to really stop it just as a matter of principle. But if not, I think Cruz Bustamante would be not only a great governor, but a better governor than Gray Davis.
Are we going to enjoy this, or is there a fundamental ugliness in it that's going to drown out the fun of Schwarzenegger around Huffington?
I guess there's a certain amount of fun. But, you know, to me, the state has some serious problems. And this notion that because we have deficits, Davis is somehow needs to pay for his job.
Hello, George Bush, yeah.
Well, exactly. I mean, I'm already using that as an argument for getting rid of George Bush next year. It's following the California GOP's argument for why Davis must go applies just as well for George Bush. But there are real problems. I mean, the state has some serious, serious problems. And the fact that we've had to put everything on hold in order to really try to shake out this whole political mess, to me, seems kind of irresponsible, especially since Davis won his election just last November. I mean, we're not talking 2 years into it, and there's, I mean, criminal indictments or, you know, things like that, then granted, you know, all the power to you. A recall would be perhaps justified. But if deficits are a reason to recall governors, I mean, we might as well take out about 45 of our state governors right now and the president while we're at it. I think I might have more fun with it if it hadn't turned into a big celebrity all-out bash with Huffington and Schwarzenegger. I mean, if it was a serious recall election between Davis, Bustamante, and McClintock and Simon, you know, or Reardon, you know, then there's a little bit more, to me it's more interesting. But the thought of Schwarzenegger being elected governor, it's kind of scary. It's my state, you know, and it's not even a partisan issue because on the issues, he seems to be generally fairly liberal. But, I mean, he's Schwarzenegger, for God's sake. I don't want him. I don't want Arianna Huffington as my governors.
Marcus, I'd want to ask you anyway the who you question, but I'm especially interested in where these successful blogging connectors come from. Glenn Reynolds is a kind of rock and roll law professor in Tennessee, educated at Yale. You are Salvadoran, though born in Chicago, grew up in Salvador. You've served in the military, Boston University law degree, now living in California. How do you describe yourself? And how does a young man like you, you're a lot younger than Glenn Reynolds, come to this eminence?
That's a big question. I mean, there was a lot of, by the time I started last May, there were already a lot of bloggers. So that, you know, it wasn't a question of I was the first on the scene, which a lot of people say about Glenn Reynolds. I don't know if it's true or not because I've never really, you know, made any real effort to find out. But, you know, there wasn't really a first mover type of situation, I don't think, with me. I think in the end of the day, I think it was I was providing a very targeted niche, which was this kind of inside baseball of politics. So we naturally drew a fairly large constituency and kept coming, kept bringing them back. I mean, that's a key, I think, to blogging in general. It's relatively easy to get people to show up to your site. It's a whole new world. It's a whole different story trying to get them to return. And you can only be really successful and really grow that success if you get people to keep coming back.
What does it?
You know, for Daily Coast, it's community. It's the fact that you have the message board regulars. You have a community that is basically operates and exists independently of me. I mean, I can literally throw up a post now that would say, California recall election, talk about it. And you'd get just as many comments. So my role in this whole thing is to provide the enabling technology and the URL and the platform for them to show up. And as a bonus, I kind of get to set the agenda. But at the end of the day, people come back not really to hear me, because I'm not Josh Marshall. I'm not an online columnist. You know, I just bring up issues. I give them my little spin, and then I let people add it, and, you know, let them discuss it. So the community aspect of it, I think, is key. I'm not quite sure how Glenn Reynolds does it, considering that he doesn't have community. He doesn't have comment boards.
But he does in a fashion, and he says, as you do, that he waits for the day when he can just quietly disappear and that the community will cook along without him. I don't know if either of you really mean it, but it's a good line. Describe your own story. How'd you fall into it?
Well, you know, going back, I'm tricultural. You know, I grew up in El Salvador in the United States. My father was Greek, so from very, very early age, I was consistently and continuously exposed to a lot of different viewpoints and a lot of different ways to look at things. Mm. I traveled extensively, just between Latin America and Europe, visiting families. So I was given a very worldly view. You know, I wasn't just very insular. I didn't stay in one place. I didn't know just one town. I mean, I moved, in my life, I've moved 12 times, major moves. You know, mm-hmm. I average move every 2-3 years. So you get around a lot. You meet a lot of different people. You get exposed to a lot of different viewpoints. I served in the military, so I got to experience that part. I lived in Germany for 3 years, so I got to experience military life. You know, I served during the Gulf War. I didn't deploy to the Gulf, but it almost happened. So I got to go through the whole sort of searching about mortality and, you know, the meaning of war and when it's justified. So, I mean, I have all these, you know, kind of different set of experiences. Mm-hmm. When I lived in El Salvador, it was during the Civil War, so I actually got to, as a child, got to experience life in a war zone and just the horrors of what war is and how it affects somebody. I was at the time, you know, up to 9 years old, 9 years of age. Other than that, you know, I was really politically inclined from a very young age. I'm not quite sure why, but maybe it was a function of the fact that I had traveled so much and I had seen so much, and I had a kind of a keen understanding that the political process had real-world repercussions to how we live. Most bloggers, you know, a lot of them were college students. There's a lack of perspective and a lot of lack of institutional knowledge and historical knowledge. Mm. That comes not from just reading a book, but actually having to live through those situations. You know, reading about what it's like to be a child in war is a lot different than actually having to live as a child in a war zone, as right. I did. Or, you know, reading about being a soldier and it's your job to go to war because you're a volunteer, so suck it up and go to war. You know, having been in that situation as well, it's not that simple and it's not that easy, and it's actually an insult to the people who serve. You know, there's an understanding that, yeah, you're being called on to serve, but there should be a reason for it other than economic interest or this desire to reshape the Middle East to someone's, you know, ideal image. Like I said, having lived abroad, different countries, I know that things are never as simple as somebody shows up as a conquering army and they get showered with flowers and rose petals. So,
do you have an idea, Marcos, where the conversation in American politics is going? I mean, George Bush is absolutely unrepentant. Everything's going fine or pretty damn well in Iraq. We'll stay there as long as we're needed, et cetera, et cetera. And yet this mounting sense of how in the world did we do this and how do we get out, where do we go on that subject?
I think it'll simmer underneath the, you know, Bush may deny it all he wants, but I think there's a lot of agitation within the military community itself, not only in the armed services, but families and military communities. I think a lot of it will just depend on they will have to drive the story. If I think they have the most credibility, and it's a question of credibility. The anti-war left doesn't have any credibility on the issue, so it's a question of waiting for those who do.
Who's listening to the Iraqis themselves, the Arab world, the Third World in general?
I think it's tragic, but I think it's completely irrelevant to the political discourse in this country. I mean, it's just
it is
tragic. In this country. I think it's just irrelevant. I mean, that's why, you know, I could talk about Iraqi casualties, but nobody cares about Iraqi casualties.
But on the other hand, I mean, isn't it ironic? We have a technology in the web for an amazingly intimate, free, democratic, open conversation with the whole world, and yet, as you say, nobody's listening. Those opinions are irrelevant. How can this be?
I mean, there's definitely a certain level of irony. What's interesting, though, is that the inverse is actually more true, is that a lot of people overseas will be able to have more of an influence with us, you know, eventually.
If we're not listening?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. The optimist in me wants to say that we'll be increasingly sensitized to what the world thinks about us. And in general, Americans like to be liked. And it's hard for Americans to realize that things maybe aren't going so well when the nightly news doesn't talk about them. They're more interested in Kobe Bryant and Arnold Schwarzenegger. But I think over time, the more people go online, the more people start tuning out to TV news and start finding alternate sources of news and information. At that point, I think it'll become a bigger issue. A lot of us on the left have made great use of international media to support our arguments because the U.S. media has basically abandoned Afghanistan, abandoned Iraq. They don't care anymore because Bush declared it all over. But you have the Guardian UK and you have Sydney Morning Herald. You have all these publications,
right.
English language publications, that are still in those countries and they're still talking about these issues. So they're able to influence the debate by providing us with a lot of the arguments we need to make our own argument.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, people like Robert Fisk, who became real cult figures among American readers in The Independent, for example. The Toronto papers have been interesting on aspects of the war and life. The Carlyle Group, for example, which has been completely ignored in the American press, is a big deal in other newspapers.
Right.
Marcus, size up this community that you keep talking about. I've read a lot of the comments from time to time on the Daily Cast. They're interesting. Describe this community. They read to me. They sound like exiles. There's a lot of nostalgia out there, a certain longing, a lot of earnestness. They're rather polite to the people they consider dead men walking, like Joe Lieberman and John Kerry. They're in love with Howard Dean. Describe the tone of this party you're throwing every day.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me that these are people that, you know, like I said, were kind of in the political wilderness, either because they weren't engaged or because they didn't have anybody to really talk to about these kind of issues. And they suddenly walk into this forum where everybody else is just like them. And, you know, they could be men, female, different ethnic groups, whatever. But politically, they've kind of hit the sweet spot where there's enough divergence in opinions where there's really good philosophical debates about whatever the issues may be. But ultimately, they're all on the same team and they're all working for the same cause. And it's a kind of a way to self-motivate to do more and do more and more and more. It's also a place to educate. One of the things that I learned really early on when I was blogging is to keep my posts purposely vague.
Meaning what?
Meaning that I left holes in so that the community could fill in. I didn't have to be an expert on everything because there was somebody who was reading me that was going to provide that missing piece and do it in a way that I never could have possibly have done without some serious amount of time and research and energy. So what that did in effect is like I said, it becomes a more of a collaborative process where I set the agenda and I kind of talk about an issue and I set the tone, but let the people actually really start filling in a lot of the gaps, start providing the sort of information that really fleshes out what I write. In the end, my posts don't live by themselves. I mean, they're not free-flowing pieces of information. I mean, they have to be taken in with the comments for them to really to get the full effect of what that post is. So this is a place where people come not just to hear what they want to hear, to preach to the converted, but to provide information so that the rest of us can all use them in our efforts to reshape this country in our image. And obviously number one in that list is a country without George Bush at the helm.
Marcus, you write on your own page that the progressive movement of the future is going to be built in large part on this digital foundation. A nice endorsement of the blogosphere, but what do you mean by it?
Traditionally, and let's look at party politics, and let's look at the Democratic Party. Both parties in general actually have, they're beholden to certain interests, you know, and special interest has a bad, negative connotation, but both parties are beholden to particular interests. For the Democratic Party, it's always been labor and the environment and civil rights groups and, you know.
And women.
Yeah, women.
And certain, Israel, in a way.
Yeah, so there's different groups. And, you know, I agree with 95% of what those groups are pushing, but I never had a voice in the political process. I was never able to impact policy unless I became a member of one of those groups. And I always thought that that was really weak because the vast majority of the public don't belong to those particular groups. There's this whole huge group, you know, otherwise known maybe as the grassroots, people who are partisan Democrats, or even partisan Republicans for that matter, who don't necessarily have a voice in what their parties are doing. So what we found from the web, what I found out from the web right away from blogging is that I was building a community, and this community was doing, it became a true community. I mean, I need a server because my server was, because I was hosting with a internet service provider. Traffic was too high, kept crashing the server. I said, please, I need help. I need a new server. Within 48 hours, I had $4,000 from community donations to help me buy a new server. So it became a true community. You know,
that's one definition of a community. I asked Julie of the Julia Project, uh-huh. You know, would you have these people over for a barbecue? She said, in fact, I've invited them all. Would you want to meet your guys and gals?
Yeah, definitely. And in fact, I get to, whenever I travel, you know, there's regulars in the message boards. And it's really funny because a lot of the regulars are celebrities in their own right within the Daily Coast community. So,
are they hungry? Are they ready to take the hill again? Are they warriors?
Definitely. When I travel sometimes, I'll say I'm going to be in Oregon, and a bunch of people who are from Oregon will email me asking if we can all get together. So I've been able to do this a couple times. It's always great. You know, now I'm raising money for the Democratic Party, and we've been able to raise a fair amount of money. We're in the mid-20s right now.
Why are you doing this, incidentally? And doesn't it compromise your...
This goes back, okay, you know, it's kind of disjointed here, but this goes back to the whole notion of the future of the grassroots. What I was finding is that these groups had this disproportionate amount of influence with the party structure because they donated a lot of money. I mean, it all came down to money because, yes, they had votes, but if you add up all their votes, it's going to be less than people who are unaffiliated with any of those groups. Just regular schmoes who aren't members of the Sierra Club. They're not members of a labor union. And they're not members of women's organizations. And yet, because they could pull together the resources and money, they had the ear of the party. And a lot of times, this has been to great detriment to the Democratic Party. Like, for example, Ohio, where Democrats don't hold a single statewide elected office because the labor unions vet every single Democratic candidate, and they're always too liberal for the state of Ohio. So I always consider that part of the problem. If the people themselves start to have a say in what the party, what party decisions were made.
But aren't these fundamentally two different ways to get influence? One, organizing articulate, independent, energized minds as you can on a blog, and on the other hand, making PAC donations. Aren't they both different and in conflict?
No, not at all. Not at all. It's a question of building a movement, and Daily Coast is a budding movement. You know, there's a certain, you know, there's a lot of conflict within our community. I mean, just walk in any thread about Joe Lieberman or Dick Ephardt or John Kerry, and you'll see everybody going at it. But ultimately, we're all on the same team. We all want the same thing. I think there has to be a realization, though, and it's something that I've been pushing, that the existing party structure is the best vehicle to accomplish what we want to accomplish.
I don't get how that leads you into fundraising for the Democrats.
Because in order to be heard, you have to speak their language, which is money.
I thought we were trying to teach them another language, which is people and
ideas. I mean, that comes with the process. But at the end of the day, we're not going to have a say. everybody can go out and vote. We can have 40,000 people go out and vote, and it's not going to make a difference. We could have 200,000 people across the country go out and vote. Terry McAuliffe is not going to make any effort to give us a, you know, to get our views on anything. They're not going to invite us to any of the DNC's shindings. On the other hand, I raised the money I raised for the party, and Terry McAuliffe is calling me and soliciting my opinion and working within the party to kind of establish his Netroots kind of structure within the party itself, again, to encourage people who are otherwise unaffiliated and kind of feel neglected and cut off from the process to get them to become more involved. Now, I just don't see a way that we can work from outside the party structure to exact any kind of change. I mean, we have to work within the party itself. And there's a certain amount of real politics involved. I mean, yeah, great, none of us really like Zell Miller, but at the end of the day, Senator Zell Miller will vote for Tom Daschle as Senate Majority Leader. That's what really matters at the end of the day. Democrats right now had at least one of the houses of Congress. We could have been investigating a lot of this stuff, dealing with the war and Bush's lies. But we don't. Republicans have both houses, and we're essentially shut off from the process. So to try to start a new movement or to align ourselves with the Greens or, you know, create a new ultra-liberal party of America, it's not going to do us any good at the end of the day, because what we need to do really is to work within the Democratic Party to get them to move over, to get the center moved back to the left. I mean, what you have is you have the DLC right now that's pushing the party to the right, and there really isn't any very good counterweight to it until Dean came aboard. And Dean is de facto the DLC's counterweight. And we want to encourage that kind of process.
When the 2004 campaign is all over, what would you like to be able to say about the role that blogs played? Dave Weiner says we'll know we've won if a blogger became president. But what's your definition?
You know, it's by the end of this election cycle, I think pretty much the whole political process will be blogged to absolute death. So I think we won already. I think just by default, by the sheer vast number of bloggers out there hyper-analyzing every single step of this primary race, it's become clear that to win this election, the candidates are going to have to be very blog savvy. They're not going to just have to have their own blogs. They're going to have to also be able to work the blogs just the way they work the media now. Now, what I want, you know, what this is all leading to this whole concept of participatory democracy that I am completely in love with, notion that everybody's going to be able to have a say in what's going on in the process, and, you know, by having these candidates with their forums, having their campaign staff reading the blogs, commenting on them, responding to people's concerns and issues, and even taking people's ideas and implementing them into their own candidacies. I think that's going to be what I hope to be the legacy of this, is this notion that, you know, not every politician is going to be able to run an effective Netroots strategy, but to win, you're going to have to be good at it. Meaning that in the future, if you don't have a blog and you don't know how to really, really manage this Netroots, you're not going to be able to compete. And that's good, because we want people who will listen to their potential supporters. We want people who are connected to the grassroots, talking to them, getting a firsthand account of what their interests and concerns are, and responding appropriately to them. I mean, we're not talking 12 people in a focus group anymore, or a random sample poll that, you know, polls 350 people. We're talking having thousands and thousands of people having a direct line straight into the heart of the campaign. Mm. That's what we need for true participatory democracy.
Pretty exciting time. And it's a great time for you to be doing what you're doing, Marcos. Marcos of the Daily Kos, K-O-S. Never to be confused with Mickey Kaus. Marcos, thank you so much. This has been interesting. This has been good. I hope we'll talk again.
Yeah, thanks so much. I hope I didn't ramble too much.
No, you're just fine.
Okay.
Thank you, Marcos.
Great. Thanks so much. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.